Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 28th video for the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll begin looking at the poetic books, starting with the book of Job. Now, Job is a very interesting book, a very deep and philosophical book. It can be difficult to understand at times. There are long arguments that can be hard to follow, yet it's a very rewarding book to read and understand. And I think the main idea, the main point of the book of Job, is very clear and very important. But first, some background issues. The author of the book of Job is anonymous. Now, I know you're probably sick of hearing this. Don't worry, soon we're going to study some books where we know the author, and the identity of the author will help us to understand the book better. But for now, we just don't know who wrote the book of Job. And so, knowing who wrote it is not necessary for understanding and applying it. And in the same way, the date it was written is unknown. The story of Job is set in the time of the patriarchs, but we don't know if the story was written down at that time or if it was written much later. In the Greek and English Bibles, Job is placed before Psalms because it was thought to be before the monarchy. And in the Hebrew Bible, it's placed after Psalms and before Proverbs. So now let's look at the organization of the book of Job. Job clearly starts with a narrative prologue. There's a wager in heaven, and Job suffers because of it, and he complains about it. And Job also ends with a separate narrative epilogue. God sets things right. And Job has a happy ending. Now, both the prologue and the epilogue, they're very important to understand the rest of the book. And we should read all of the arguments between these in light of the prologue and epilogue. And as I mentioned, both of them are narrative, but the rest of the book of Job is poetry. So then after the prologue, is a series of dialogues. Job and his three friends argue about why Job suffers. And there are three cycles of dialogue that go back and forth. Job speaks and Eliphaz responds. Job responds and then Bildad responds. Then Job responds to him and finally Zophar responds. Now it goes through this series of speakers three times in the dialogues. And then near the end of the book, there are three longer monologues. Job has his final say in a long discourse without any input from his friends. And then Elihu puts in his two cents. And then God gets the final word. And God's final monologue includes a bit of reaction from Job, a little bit of back and forth, but it's mostly God speaking. But then at the heart of the book is chapter 28 that I've titled The Hymn of Wisdom. Now this passage raises and answers the most pressing issue from the entire book. That is, where can wisdom be found? Who has wisdom? In other words, who is qualified to give the answers to all the other questions that this book raises? And notice by the structure of the book that this central section is emphasized, and God's monologues are stressed as well as the most important parts of the book. Now let's dive into the content of the book of Job, starting with some key verses. The first is chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil." Now, this passage introduces the story, but it also makes a very important point that Job was blameless and upright. He feared God and avoided evil. Now, both of these phrases, even the precise words, they're going to be very important because they're quoted later in the book. Next is chapter 1, verses 20 through 22, and chapter 2, verse 10. And they say, "At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship. He said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.' In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." Then in chapter 2, Job replied to his wife. He said, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said." Now, in these two passages, Job is responding to the tremendous suffering he has just experienced. And these passages, like the previous one, they clearly establish Job was innocent. He did not deserve the suffering he was experiencing, nor did he deserve the accusations that he was about to experience from his friends. So this issue is settled at the very beginning of the story, and the reader knows, so that when Job's friends are going to question and attack his innocence, you know, the reader knows better. Then chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth." This verse is also after Job had suffered the loss of all his property, most of his family, and his health. And he, understandably, he was miserable. And he went so far as to say it would have been better had he never been born. And this demonstrates the severity of Job's suffering. And next is chapter 6, verses 1 through 3 and verses 8 through 10, which says, "Then Job replied, 'If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed in the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy in unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One.'" Now, this passage also gives expression to the intensity of Job's suffering, but Job also expresses his innocence in all the suffering that he's hanging on to. Then it's Job chapter 19, verses 4 through 7, and verses 21 through 27. Job begins speaking to his friends. He says, "If it is true that I've gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. If indeed you would exalt yourself above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry, 'I've been wronged,' I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice. Have pity on me, my friends, have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me." Now, there's a lot in this passage. Job expresses his frustration in a few directions. First, he challenges his friends for being lousy counselors and accusing him instead of consoling him. Then he complains that God had wronged him by bringing this misery when he did not deserve it. And he expresses his wish for justice, and he wants the record to be set straight. And finally, he expresses his hope against hope that he would find justice even after the grave, if necessary, that somehow someone would act as redeemer in his case. And then is chapter 28, verses 12 through 13, and verses 20 through 28. It says, "But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil, that is understanding." Now, like I mentioned, this passage is at the center of the book, addressing the central question, who has wisdom to answer life's difficult questions? And the answer is, God alone does. But God has told humanity all that we need to know, that the fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to avoid evil is understanding. Now notice that these two things that are said to be wisdom and understanding, those are the very words that used to describe the characteristics of Job in the first verse of this book. Then is chapter 38, verses 1 through 4. It says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand." And then it goes on. And this passage is the beginning of God's response to Job. And God does not answer Job's questions. God asks the questions. And he challenges Job's right to question God and challenges Job's ability to comprehend the things that only God can understand. And then is Job chapter 40, verses 1 through 14. "The Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Then Job answered the Lord, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's, and can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor. Clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you." See, in this passage, God continues his questioning of Job. And Job reacts with a brilliant response. He repents. He acknowledges he's talking about the things that he does not know, and he shuts up. But God continues to press the point. He challenges Job to do better in running the moral universe and doing justice. A very kind of sarcastic, but it makes the point, as we'll talk about a little bit later. And that brings us to Job chapter 42, verses 1 through 7. It says, "Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You ask, Who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me. My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And after the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now this is Job's second response, and like the first, it's appropriate. Job acknowledges that he was wrong to question God, because he's not in the same category of God, and he repents. And at the end of this passage, God gives the evaluation of all the arguments up to this point, that Job had spoken rightly and his friends had not. And finally, it's chapter 42, verses 10 through 12. It says, after Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord made him prosperous again and gave him twice as much as he had before. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. Now, this passage is the happy ending of the book. God restores all that Job had lost and even more. And if this book did not have a happy ending, then God's justice could be questioned. And the problem with Job, like sometimes with us, is that God's justice is questioned before the ending has come. These then are some of the key verses in the book of Job. Now let's try to look at the content of the Job in more detail, starting with the prose introduction. Now there are two rounds in this introduction, and both follow a very similar pattern. First, Satan approaches God, and God confronts Satan with what are you doing here? And Satan kind of sasses God, implying that God, you know, you're failing with humans. But God brings up Job. And Satan accuses Job. And that's what he does. He's an accuser. By that I mean, he tries to turn God against Job, not so much tempting Job to turn Job against God. He says to God, you know, Job only serves you for the reward that he's given. Now, the technical term for this is eudaimonism, serving God only for what we get out of it and not because we love God. That is a mercenary faith, which does not honor God and is not really true Christian faith. But God grants the accuser permission to harm Job with clear restraints. That is, Satan can only do what God has specifically allowed him to do. And Satan does his worst to Job, and Job suffers, but Job responds with worship, and he does not sin. Now, the second time through, the response is toned down a second time. Job he's reeling, and his faith is beginning to waver. He's no longer as adamant and excited in his worship, and yet he still does not sin. And that brings up the overall problem that the book of Job presents us. That is the surface issue that the book of Job addresses. First, Job is righteous. Very clearly says so. But then Job suffers tremendously. Do you see the problem? This calls into question Deuteronomistic theology. And it calls into question God's justice. And the rest of this book struggles with this problem and offers various solutions. Now, Deuteronomistic theology, as we've seen, is the general rule. But we need to be a little careful not to press it hard and fast in every specific situation. You know, the general rule is always true, all other things being equal. But sometimes, not all things are always equal. Let me illustrate this. I could say, if you drive carefully, you'll avoid an accident. And that's true. as far as it goes. But it doesn't take into account the possibility of other drivers or mechanical failures or icy roads. So what I'm getting at is there's more going on here than just Deuteronomistic theology. It's more than a question of Job's righteousness and reward. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the issues is the time gap between the act and the reward for that act or the punishment. Now, sometimes there is a time lapse before the reward, just like the promise is tested. And let's be honest, if we were rewarded or punished immediately, that would train us to be good only for selfish reasons, which would train us in sin and hypocrisy. But the way that God has set up the world, this delay between virtue and reward and between sin and punishment can train us in faith. That we trust God's promises and threats even when we don't see them immediately, even when they're tested. But now let's skip to the end and look at the epilogue. We see that in the end of the story, God sides with Job, and God rules against the three friends. And therefore, we need to read all the rest of the book, knowing that in the arguments, ultimately Job is right and his friends are wrong. Now, that does not mean that everything Job says is right, or that everything the friends say is wrong. We need to weed through that a little bit more carefully. But the overall approach and the overall conclusions, Job is right and his friends are wrong. And in the epilogue, God completely ignores Elihu. He doesn't even give his monologue a response, which I think says something about his monologue. And God blesses Job. He gives him a double portion of the property he had and the same number of children. And notice that God never explains to Job. He doesn't tell him what happened in the introduction, and he doesn't even answer his questions. Job is left completely in the dark about why all these things happened to him. Because that's not what is most important for Job to know in this story. Job's lessons and our lessons from the book of Job are much more important than this. So that brings us to the questions addressed in the book of Job. First question, is Job righteous? Remember, in verse 1, he's described as fearing God, turning away from evil, upright and righteous. So that seems like a no-brainer. But this question is actually at the heart of the dialogue with his friends, because they keep questioning his innocence. And the second question, is God just? And again, this seems like an easy question, but it is also questioned and debated throughout this book. And third, who has wisdom? In other words, who is qualified to judge and answer these questions? And then the final question is, does Job serve God only for God's blessings? And I also want to point out a non-question, a question that's never raised in this book. The book of Job never asks the question, why do the innocent suffer? See, Job and his friends, they never find out why Job suffered. And this book never addresses this question in these terms. And the reader already knows from the introduction why Job is suffering. Now, I think the book of Job has a lot to say to this question, and when we'll get there, but I don't think it addresses it in the way you might think. And personally, whenever I'm asked this question, why do innocent people suffer, I ask them, well, go find me a truly righteous, innocent person who suffers, and then I'll tell you why. And then I point out that there's only one man who is truly righteous. And I know the reason he suffered is because he was crucified for our sins to purchase our salvation. Problem solved. Okay, now I want to go on to try to survey the dialogues and the monologues in this book by summarizing some of the main arguments of each group. And we'll start with the perspective of Job's so-called friends. Now, I put friends in inverted commas because they are his friends, but in this book, they certainly don't act like friends. They argue that the wicked are always punished, period. God only rewards the righteous. He never allows the righteous to suffer. The wicked are the ones that suffer. Does that sound familiar? And because of this theology that the righteous never suffer, the wicked suffer, they conclude, because Job is suffering, therefore Job is guilty. And he should repent.
It's your own fault for just getting what you deserve.
And throughout the dialogues, they grow more and more aggressive in their accusation. At first, they're like, well, Job, maybe you should consider the possibility that maybe you sinned a little bit and don't realize it. But by the end of the dialogues, they're like, yo, you're the worst sinner ever. Now, on the one hand, they rightly have the perspective of Deuteronomistic theology, God's justice. But on the other hand, they are overly simplistic and naive in the way that they apply it. They think that they are wise enough to dictate how it works out in every circumstance. They have the right theology, but they don't apply it with wisdom, and they don't apply it with compassion. They've taken what they truly know and forced God to conform to their understanding. They can't conceive of the possibility that God would do things beyond their narrow view or their narrow way of doing things. They allow their theology to distort reality. And now let's look at Job's perspective. Job's speeches basically go back and forth between two directions. He speaks in reply to his friends, rebuffing their accusations and criticizing their lack of compassion. But he also speaks in anguish to God, asking for help, asking for answers, asking for resolution. Job says, I'm innocent. I don't deserve this level of suffering. And he also says, I'm miserable. This really sucks. He curses his birth and says it would be better if you'd never been born. And he says, my so-called friends, they are not helping, but they are hurting. If they just kept their mouths shut, they'd be better comforters than they are. And he says, I'm innocent. Now, I know I already said this, but I'm repeating it because Job keeps repeating it. And Job keeps bringing it up because his friends keep bringing it up. Job continually needs to deny his guilt. And Job also says, I want to ask God why this is happening to me. And Job even goes so far as to question God's running of the moral universe. Job denies that the wicked are always punished. And he denies that God is giving him justice. And Job says, I wish I could talk to God about what is happening. But God is too distant. And He doesn't have to answer me. And Job, he's seeking answers. It's kind of like he's blindly searching in the dark, but he's searching. He's groping and he goes beyond conventional wisdom, trying to find a satisfactory answer. And by this groping out, he comes actually pretty close to some New Testament teaching about resurrection and eternal judgment. But Job does say, God is so far removed, I need an intermediary to go between us. You know, in chapter 9, verse 33, Job calls on God to help him speak to God. And it doesn't make sense. But like I said, Job is grasping. But in this, he hits on the New Testament idea of a mediator between God and man who is able to relate to both. And finally, Job says, I have hope against hope that somehow God will make it right. Even if I die, I will somehow see my Redeemer and my redemption. Now, then for time's sake, I'm not going to summarize Elihu's perspective. He's kind of the voice of the angry youth who think they know it all, and he arrogantly judges Job and his friends for not finding the answers, but he doesn't really add anything to the discussion. Everything he says has already been said, but he thinks he's so smart. Now, trust me, I've been there myself. And like I already mentioned, God ignores Elihu. So let's go on and let's explore Job chapter 28, the hymn on wisdom. It starts by raising the question, where is wisdom found? Earthly treasure can be found. Might be hard. People have to go to great lengths, dig deep in the earth. They have great ingenuity and success to find gold and precious minerals, etc. But wisdom is more precious than treasure. And man cannot find wisdom, no matter how hard he looks. It's beyond our ability to know wisdom on our own. But God can find wisdom because it's from Him. True wisdom is from God. We figured out mining, we figured out electricity, technology, genetics, etc. But in our own day and age, all of this scientific and technological success tends to blind us to the reality that mankind has totally failed to figure out the things that really matter. We have really cool phones, but wasted lives. We have near limitless information, but hardly any wisdom and no peace. Man has no way to find true wisdom except for God. And yet wisdom can be known because God has revealed true wisdom, because God has revealed Himself. And He's made it known that true wisdom is the fear of the Lord and turning away from evil. Remember Job. He is blameless and upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. That is wisdom. And now let's look at God's speeches. Now, first, a parenthetical point from this section. God is awesome. Now, God's point in these speeches is to answer Job, not necessarily to describe Himself, but from his speeches, we gain insight to God's greatness, His power, His wisdom, and His care for even the smallest details of His creation. Now, of course, we should hear God's message to Job, but we should also be awed by who God is. Okay, now back to God's perspective. Now the fact that God speaks at all, that's in itself a profound answer. He does care. He doesn't leave Job hanging, and He does not allow His justice to be questioned forever. Now God's speeches are very gentle and yet very firm with Job. And there's no question who is in authority in this discussion. In God's first speech, He challenges Job's ignorance. He doesn't answer Job's questions, but He asks questions of His own. You know, he changes the subject. Not only do Job and his friends have the wrong answers, they're not even asking the right questions. So He challenges Job's understanding. Job doesn't understand creation. Now to us, creation is a chaos with a complexity beyond our imagination. But to God, it's a cosmic dance completely under His control. Every atom, every particle. Job doesn't understand the weather. It's chaos. And yet it as well is under God's control. Every lightning bolt, every drop of rain. Job doesn't understand wild animals. Job doesn't even understand the domestic animals that he works with every day. And the point of all this is that God is in control, even if it doesn't appear so to Job's limited understanding. And in the midst of this, chapter 38, verse 36, stresses that God is the source of wisdom and understanding. Now the point If Job has no handle whatsoever on these natural things, how then can he presume to be able to address the problem of evil? Why does he think he's able to contend with and correct God? The physical world, which Job does not understand, is well within God's control. And so Job is invited to make the connection that the moral order, which he also does not understand, is equally as glorious, equally complex, and yet equally under God's control and command. Therefore, Job can have confidence that it's going to work out in the moral world, just like he has confidence the sun is going to rise and the rain is going to fall. And God's final challenge in this first section is, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let the one who accuses God answer him. And under this question, Job makes a brilliant response. He says, I am unworthy. I cannot reply. I will shut up now. But then God presses ahead with his second speech. And in this section, he challenges Job's littleness and Job's inability. He says, I'm going to question you again. Do you discredit me to justify yourself? Now, Job was rightly puzzled by his moral problem, but Job's solution was to throw God's justice under the bus and say, I think I'm right, so therefore God must be wrong. And God responds by pointing out how inappropriate that is. He goes on, are you as strong as God? Then by all means, do better. And God's very kind of sarcastic in this, at this point. He says, why don't you go ahead and work out justice in the world? I'll stand back and watch. And when you get it all figured out, then I'll be impressed. And the implication is that if you can't do this, why are you criticizing the way that I do justice? And then God goes on about Job's lack of power. He says, can you control the behemoth or Leviathan? Two creatures that go far beyond Job's strength. But God says, you know what? I can control them. I treat them like pets. You can't control them. You have no power. So how can you presume to control the moral universe? Now, this might seem like God is just browbeating Job and pulling the power trip to shut Job up. But no, that's not what is happening. God is being very gracious to Job by helping him to accurately see his own place in the universe. That is, God helps Job to see that he's not God. And that is all in order to lead up to the point and the final challenge of this section. And the question is, what makes you think you are able to know these things? Why do you assume that you're even able to understand what's going on here? And the point is that Job is not qualified to make these judgments. He's not even qualified to dialogue with God about these things. They are way over Job's head. They are beyond his ability and his station. And again, this is not a put down to win an argument, but it's just an honest appraisal of the situation. You know, some things you just don't explain to a toddler, not because you're hiding anything from them, but because they're just not able yet to understand. And then Job's replies. He echoes what God had said, and then he responds. Job says, I know that you can do all things. No one thwarts your plans. Now, by the way, many Christians want to solve the problem of evil by appealing to free will. But I think the book of Job just does not allow that answer. It says, no one thwarts God's plans. And then Job parrots God's first question. God had said, who obscures my counsel in 38:2? And Job responds to that. He says, I spoke of things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for my knowledge. And God had said, I will question you and you will answer me in chapter 40, verse 7. And Job responds, I have heard, but now I see. I despise myself and I repent. Now notice what Job does not say. Job does not say, okay, I see it all now. You have successfully explained it to me. You've lived up to my standards. And Job does not say, oh, now I see the whole picture. I withdraw the charges because you have proved yourself and I have judged you to be innocent. No. Rather, Job says, now I see that I don't understand. I'm beyond my element. I'm in over my head. I am unable to understand what's going on here, and I shouldn't have even thought I could ask these questions. You see, Job did not get an answer to his question, but he got an understanding of his relationship to God and God's relationship to his question. God is God, God knows, and that's enough. Now let me try to draw some conclusions from this discussion. There is much wisdom in knowing the limit and the contingency of human wisdom. And this book challenges human arrogance that we think we can figure everything out. It rebukes us for trusting in our own abilities. There are some questions that are beyond us. We need revelation from God in order to know. We are dependent. We are contingent. And we need humility like a child to realize this, something that is sadly lacking in our culture today. See, the friend's fallacy is that they overestimated their grasp of wisdom. They decided for themselves what God must do and how. And we're in the same situation they are. We are just as incapable of figuring out the mystery of why God does things the way he does. We are unable to understand everything about how the moral universe works. And therefore, we cannot rely on our own judgment.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
We need to clearly grasp that God is not obligated to explain himself to fallen human beings. He doesn't have to account for everything to his children. And we're arrogant beyond measure if we demand him to do so. Now, I know that this answer does not satisfy curious skeptics, but it's biblical, and therefore I think it's the wisest possible answer. You know, honestly, I wish I could tell you exactly why everything happens. I wish I could answer all your questions. I wish I could give an airtight explanation of the problem of evil. But if I said I could, I'd be lying. And I'd be making the same mistake as Job's friends. So now, let's look at the theological themes of Job by revisiting the questions. First question, is God just? Now, the immediate answer is yes, of course he is. But a better answer is to disavow the question. Just by whose standards? Are we qualified to judge if God is just or not? See, the book of Job leaves absolutely no room whatsoever for the idea that God is responsible to us or answerable to us. God is the one that asks the questions, not us. And if God would have answered Job on his own terms, it would have left the impression that God must answer to humans, and God will not allow us to think that way. We cannot stand in judgment of God because he is God and we are not. And the next question is, who has wisdom? Well, God does. That's who. And he has revealed what we need to know about wisdom. The fear of the Lord is wisdom, and turning away from evil is understanding. And the question of why do the righteous suffer? Well, the book of Job lets us know we're unqualified to answer this question completely. We're unable to understand because it's beyond our finite mind and our dependent station. So we need to trust God for the answer. You see, the book of Job is sneaky. We have been challenging the book of Job with our questions, but all the while this has been happening, the book of Job has been challenging us with the real questions. So now, after all this, let's look at the real questions of the book of Job, what the book of Job is really about. See, the book of Job challenges the readers with these questions. And the first is, can God be trusted? Now, the obvious answer is yes. But that's a real easy answer to give in a purely academic setting. But what answer do we give when we're suffering? Can God be trusted? Do we trust God in the dark? Do we trust God in situations when we're way over our head? Now, I hope that your faith is strengthened so that you will give the right answer in the middle of suffering. Read Romans chapter 8. Think about how many of God's promises ever fail. Meditate on the cross of Christ and the resurrection. And when you suffer, hang on to the truth that God can indeed be trusted, even in your circumstances. God's promises never fail. And the second question is, do we serve God for blessings, or are we blessed because we serve God? That is, the related challenge to us is, will we serve God if the blessings don't come immediately? Will we still serve God if the blessings don't look like what we expected or hoped for? Will we serve God even if the blessings are taken away? That is, what do we love more, the blessings or God? Do we love God himself? Or do we only love God for what he can give us? And the final challenging question of Job is, are we content with creaturehood? That is, are we okay with having a creaturely dependence and the kind of wisdom that's fitting for a creature? That is, it's limited. Without aspiring to have a godlike wisdom, which is beyond our reach. Do we serve God even when we don't understand? Are we okay with not having all the answers, when we have to live by trust and not by sight? Remember the two parts of the first temptation way back in Genesis chapter 3. The first is to doubt God. Serpent said, did God really say? And Job says, can God be trusted? And the second part is to want to be like God. The serpent said, oh, you can be like God, knowing good and evil, determining good and evil for yourself. But Job asked, are we content with creaturehood, trusting God to define good and evil for us? Now, just to be clear, we should learn and understand all that we can. But we also, in that learning, we recognize that there are some things that God has put out of our reach. And we should stop where God's revelation stops. And we should be careful not to speculate beyond what we can know. You know, a lot of heresies start that way. And the right attitude is to love and trust God, whether we understand or not.
Do you have to have it all figured out before it does you any good?
What are you doing?
Come on, have a little faith.
So now let's review what we've learned in the book of Job. First, let's review the organization. The five sections are prologue, dialogues, hymn on wisdom, monologues, and epilogue. A lot of logs there. And notice that the organization puts the emphasis on the hymn of wisdom. And let's review the questions of Job. They are, can God be trusted? Why do you serve God? And are you content to be a creature? Wow, that's a lot of information, some deep philosophical stuff. Now, I told you that Job is a deep and somewhat difficult book, but I hope from the survey that you've gained a better understanding of the book and have gained a clearer picture of your relationship to God and have even received encouragement to trust Him in every situation. In the next section, we're going to continue with the poetic books by looking at the book of Psalms. Thanks for watching.